Welcome to the Audio Digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Michael Roy with highlights for the month of October 2008. This month, our Treatment and Psychiatry feature will discuss drug treatment of breast cancer and depression. We'll also highlight a study in which olanzapine was used to treat low body weight and obsessive thinking in women with anorexia nervosa. We'll then focus on a report that examined whether compulsive hoarding is a symptom of obsessive-compulsive disorder, a distinct syndrome, or both. An editorial highlighting this report will provide a developmental and evolutionary perspective. From there, we'll turn our attention to bipolar mania and discuss a clinical trial of adjunctive aripiprazole for patients who are partially non-responsive to valproate or lithium. We'll conclude with an article that compared two sets of criteria for diagnosing post-traumatic stress disorder in children exposed to motor vehicle accidents. We begin now with our treatment and psychiatry feature, where this month, Lynn Henry and colleagues present drug interactions and pharmacogenomics in the treatment of breast cancer and depression. They introduced the topic with the hypothetical case of a 45-year-old premenopausal woman. This woman was diagnosed with major depressive disorder 10 years ago and was successfully treated for 12 months with fluoxetine. 1 year ago, she was diagnosed with estrogen receptor-positive invasive breast cancer. She underwent surgery, followed by chemotherapy, and then radiation therapy. For the past 6 months, she has been treated with tamoxifen, a selective estrogen receptor modulator, to reduce the likelihood of breast cancer recurrence. She has tolerated it relatively well, except for moderately bothersome hot flashes, for which she has received no pharmacotherapy. Recently, however, she developed recurrent depressive symptoms and sought treatment from her psychiatrist. This case leads us to examine concurrent treatment for depression and hot flashes in women with breast cancer, and describe how some of these agents compromise the efficacy of the cancer treatment or increase its toxicity. The focus is on endocrine therapy for invasive breast cancer. This is common because the majority of women with invasive breast cancer have tumors that express estrogen receptor and/or progesterone receptor on the cell surfaces. These women benefit from tamoxifen or agents that decrease circulating estrogen levels, such as aromatase inhibitors. At present, tamoxifen is the standard of care for treatment of premenopausal women with invasive breast cancer that's estrogen receptor positive. For postmenopausal women, both tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitors are acceptable treatments. Many women with non-invasive breast cancer are also offered tamoxifen to reduce the risk of recurrence or a new primary tumor. In addition, women at high risk for breast cancer may be recommended for therapy with tamoxifen or raloxifene. Tamoxifen has both estrogenic and anti-estrogenic activity, depending on the target organ. It's anti-estrogenic in the breast and in the brain. The relationship of anti-estrogen therapy to depression and anxiety, and to hot flashes, has led to an intersection between clinical oncology and clinical psychiatry. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors and serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors decrease vasomotor symptoms in healthy menopausal women and in women with breast cancer either on or off endocrine therapy. Tamoxifen itself is a relatively weak selective estrogen receptor modulator. It's considered to be a classical prodrug. That is, it's converted to metabolites that are more potent than the parent drug itself. It's primarily metabolized in the liver by the cytochrome P450 system to a number of active metabolites. One of these is endoxifen, which is approximately 100 times more active as an anti-estrogen than the parent compound. Tamoxifen is converted to endoxifen principally by an enzyme that is coded for by the most studied gene in the cytochrome P450 system, which is the gene for the 2D6 enzyme. Many of the different alleles for this gene confer decreased or absent gene activity. In addition to genetic inactivation, the functioning of this enzyme can be inhibited by medications. Therefore, use of 2D6 inhibitors in patients who are being treated with tamoxifen could affect breast cancer outcomes. That is, inhibiting the enzymatic conversion of tamoxifen to endoxifen may decrease the efficacy of tamoxifen therapy. Several SSRIs and SNRIs are potent, moderate, or mild inhibitors of the 2D6 enzyme. For instance, women with a typical genotype who were treated with tamoxifen had decreases in endoxifen concentration after they started taking paroxetine. An observational study of women treated with tamoxifen showed low serum levels of endoxifen in those who also took strong inhibitors of the 2D6 enzyme, such as paroxetine and fluoxetine. Endoxifen levels were intermediate in those treated with weak inhibitors, such as sertraline and citalopram. Venlafaxine does not inhibit 2D6, and it had little effect on endoxifen concentration. The combined influence of concomitant medications and genotype was also investigated in a retrospective patient cohort. Information about medications and genotype was used to classify the patient's metabolizer status. Women with decreased 2D6 activity had increased rates of breast cancer recurrence and shorter intervals without relapse. Although these studies are relatively small, they suggest that SSRIs and SNRIs with minimal effect on 2D6 enzyme activity are unlikely to interfere with the formation of endoxifen. These include citalopram and venlafaxine. However, for patients who have not responded to these medications or who can't tolerate them, it may be necessary to use medications that are potent 2D6 inhibitors. In these situations, the psychiatrist should discuss therapy options with the treating oncologist, since alternative endocrine therapies for the breast cancer may be available. For example, ovarian suppression can be used for treating premenopausal women, and aromatase inhibitor therapy can be an excellent option for postmenopausal women. The patient in the case vignette was interested in taking a single medication that could treat both her depressive symptoms and her hot flashes. She had heard that some antidepressants were able to manage both, and she requested fluoxetine because she had previously tolerated it well. However, her psychiatrist had heard about the possible drug-drug interactions between tamoxifen and some SSRIs, and he encouraged the patient to consider a different antidepressant to avoid a potential decrease in tamoxifen efficacy. The psychiatrist initiated therapy with extended-release venlafaxine, and the patient is currently taking 75 milligrams daily. She has tolerated it well, her depressive symptoms have improved, and her hot flashes are now mild and infrequent. Now, we'll highlight the randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial by Hani Basada and colleagues, in which olanzapine was used in the treatment of low body weight and obsessive thinking in women with anorexia nervosa. Extended hospitalizations can restore weight to emaciated individuals, but they are expensive and discouraged by private insurance plans. Few rigorous controlled trials have been conducted, but it appears that selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, standard neuroleptics, and psychological treatments administered during weight restoration have not been predictably effective in increasing the rate of weight gain or reducing psychological symptoms. Olanzapine is an atypical antipsychotic that's a serotonin and dopamine antagonist, and it's reported to increase weight. Weight gain appears to be more common among individuals with a low body mass index at baseline. In addition, olanzapine may have some anti-obsessive and antidepressant properties. This study involved patients with anorexia nervosa who were attending an intensive day hospital program for eating disorders 4 days a week. In addition, they were randomly assigned to either olanzapine or placebo for 10 weeks. The randomization was stratified according to the subtype of anorexia nervosa, either restricting or binging and purging. 16 patients were assigned to olanzapine, and 18 were assigned to placebo. The olanzapine dose began at 2.5 milligrams per day, and the maximum was 10 milligrams per day. After treatment, the two groups were compared in regard to the rate of weight gain, the time until achievement of the target weight, and changes in depression, anxiety, obsessions, and compulsions. The patients in both groups showed significant increases in body mass index. However, those receiving olanzapine gained weight faster than those receiving placebo. The target weight was reached by 56% of the patients receiving placebo and 88% of those receiving olanzapine. Weight restoration took a mean of 8 weeks for olanzapine and 10 weeks for placebo. The two treatments showed no difference in the change in depression and anxiety scores. Both of them also led to decreases in obsessions and compulsions. However, olanzapine resulted in greater improvement in the scores for obsessive symptoms. Compulsive behavior was the focus of Alberto Pertusa and colleagues. They designed a study to answer the question, compulsive hoarding, OCD symptom, distinct clinical syndrome, or both. Between 15 and 40% of patients with obsessive compulsive disorder report compulsions that involve hoarding and saving. In OCD, hoarding symptoms have been associated with greater comorbidity, impaired functioning, reduced insight, poor response to standard psychological and drug treatments, and a distinct genetic and neurobiological profile. These suggest that compulsive hoarding may be an etiologically distinct variant of OCD. It's also possible that compulsive hoarding is a separate syndrome that can be comorbid with OCD. This idea is supported by the fact that hoarding is often present in other psychiatric disorders, and even without any major psychopathology. This study compared 25 individuals with severe compulsive hoarding who met the DSM-IV criteria for OCD, and 27 with severe hoarding who did not meet the OCD criteria. The authors also recruited OCD patients without hoarding symptoms, individuals with other anxiety disorders, and community subjects. The patients with compulsive hoarding were more likely to be women and to be older. The majority of participants in the two hoarding groups reported having at least one relative with significant hoarding behavior. those with hoarding but not OCD also reported a greater family history of OCD than the subjects with other anxiety disorders and the community comparison subjects. Together, these findings suggest that there are both distinct and common genetic and environmental factors in the OCD and hoarding phenotypes. Although the hoarding behaviors in the two hoarding groups were similar in some respects, there were several important differences. The extent of clutter reported in the two groups was substantial and comparable, and the majority of each group reported that their hoarding was due to the emotional or intrinsic value of the possessions. However, about one quarter of those with OCD reported other obsessional ideas, such as a fear of catastrophic consequences. Some of those with OCD also collected bizarre items, such as hair and rotten food. Participants in the two hoarding groups reported similar ages at the onset of hoarding, although those with OCD reported having excess clutter at an earlier age than those without OCD. Both groups had high rates of social phobia. Those with OCD were more likely to receive a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder than were those without OCD. Those with OCD also endorsed more cluster C personality traits. However, the two hoarding groups did not differ in the total number of personality disorder traits. In their editorial that discusses the Pertusa study, James Leckman and Michael Block present a developmental and evolutionary perspective on obsessive-compulsive disorder. Leckman and Block point out that OCD is heterogeneous in its clinical presentation. Specific subtypes have been proposed, such as forms characterized by tics, early onset, and PANDAS, or pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorders associated with streptococcal infections. There is also compelling evidence for developmental and dimensional approaches to OCD, as well as viewing OCD as part of a larger spectrum of disorders, including trichotillomania, body dysmorphic disorder, and possibly compulsive hoarding. As a result, there are conflicting views regarding how best to classify OCD in the next edition of DSM. A brief overview may be of value. Most children develop a variety of rituals, habits, routines, and preferences. Some of these resemble the behaviors in OCD. Young children, particularly those around the age of 2.5, begin to establish rigid routines. Rather than addressing emotional needs, those rituals may help children master the task of a specific developmental epoch, for instance, matters of feeding, toileting, and dressing. By the time the children are 3, more than 80% of parents report the presence of a bedtime ritual. Less well known is that for most children, there is a regular sequence, and appearing next is the need to arrange things just right or in a symmetrical pattern. This is followed by the child's being very concerned with dirt and germs, and finally the need to collect and store objects. Most of these behaviors peak at age 3, but hoarding shows a monotonic increase until at least age 6, when more than 60% of normal children display this trait. The earlier the age at which these concerns appear, the more advanced is the child's developmental level. Children with severe intellectual disabilities, whose mental age remains low, show a persistence of many of these obsessive-compulsive behaviors. This has led some to conclude that obsessive-compulsive behaviors are evolutionarily conserved and have a tendency to reappear normally at particular developmental transitions, such as falling in love or the advent of a firstborn infant. These developmental data also support the view that OCD is composed of temporally stable symptom dimensions, and that it results from a developmental sequence in which both genetic and environmental familial factors play critical roles. Within clinical populations, the existence of these symptom dimensions appears beyond doubt. One dimension is forbidden thoughts. Another includes obsessions with symmetry and exactness, along with ordering and arranging rituals, as well as counting and repeating rituals. The third dimension is contamination obsessions and compulsive washing. The fourth is hoarding, both obsessions and compulsions. Although it seems useful for DSM-5 to have a combined category and dimension approach, more data are needed, except in the case of compulsive hoarding. In the naturalistic study by Pertusa and colleagues, and the recent population-based study by Samuels and colleagues, OCD patients with prominent hoarding symptoms differed from those without hoarding across many important respects. These include an earlier onset, but later presentation for treatment. Hoarding symptoms are consistently associated with poor response and premature dropout from cognitive behavioral therapy for OCD. The picture with regard to pharmacological interventions is less clear-cut. Most reports indicate that hoarding is a strong predictor of poor response. However, in one recent study of OCD, compulsive hoarders responded as well to paroxetine as non-hoarding patients. The most remarkable part of the hoarding story is that there have been a number of reports that compulsive hoarding can newly emerge as a result of brain injury. The greatest lesion overlap in hoarders is in the right medial prefrontal cortex, orbital frontal cortex, anterior cingulate cortex, and adjacent white matter. we do not fully understand the relationship between brain lesions and patterns of brain activity. However, both lesion and functional imaging studies indicate the involvement of specific frontal limbic brain regions in compulsive hoarders. These areas are largely distinct from the circuits often implicated in OCD proper. This difference speaks the most directly to the possibility of a separate set of neural circuits underlying our tendency to be collectors. Now we'll focus on the treatment of bipolar disorder. Eduard Vieda and colleagues report on the efficacy of adjunctive aripiprazole to either valproate or lithium in bipolar mania patients partially non-responsive to valproate-lithium monotherapy. Partial non-response was defined as a score of 16 or higher on the Young Mania Rating Scale. The patients were randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive adjunctive treatment with either aripiprazole or placebo. The double-blind treatment lasted 6 weeks and was stratified by the type of mood stabilizer. The aripiprazole dose began at 15 milligrams per day and could be adjusted after a week to 30 milligrams on the basis of tolerability or clinical response. About 130 patients were randomly assigned to placebo, and 253 were assigned to aripiprazole. Treatment was completed by approximately 80% of each group. The rate of discontinuation due to adverse events was 9% for aripiprazole and 5% for placebo. The primary efficacy measure was the mean change from baseline in the total mania score, with the last observation carried forward. At week 6, the decrease was 13.3 points for aripiprazole and 10.7 for placebo. The difference was significant at week 1 and at all subsequent weeks. In a post-hoc analysis, the differences were examined for each item on the Young Mania Rating Scale. Improvements were significantly greater for aripiprazole on elevated mood, sexual interest, irritability, speech, disruptive or aggressive behavior, and insight. Among the patients taking valproate, adjunctive aripiprazole produced significantly greater improvements in the total score than placebo from day 4 through week 6. For the lithium subgroup, the improvement at week 6 with aripiprazole was numerically greater than with placebo, but the difference was not significant. Secondary outcome measures also favored aripiprazole. Remission was defined as a total score of 12 or less on the Young Mania Rating Scale. The rate of remission was 66% for aripiprazole and 51% for placebo. The valproate and lithium subgroups did not differ significantly from each other. The difference in improvement in depression scores between aripiprazole and placebo was not statistically significant. However, the proportion of patients with emergent depression was 17% for placebo, but only 8% for aripiprazole. There was also a significant difference favoring aripiprazole in the mean change on a measure of impaired functioning. Extrapyramidal symptoms were reported in 28% of the aripiprazole group and 14% of the placebo group. The most frequently reported extrapyramidal symptom was akathisia. The lithium subgroup showed higher rates of akathisia and tremor than the valproate subgroup. The majority of akathisia in the aripiprazole group began in the first 3 weeks of treatment. It led to discontinuation in 13 aripiprazole patients and 1 placebo patient. Small changes from baseline in body weight were observed with both treatments and did not differ significantly between groups. There were no clinically meaningful differences between treatments in laboratory parameters, and aripiprazole was not associated with any clinically relevant changes in vital signs or ECG abnormalities. It's important to establish the safety and tolerability of an adjunctive therapy, even if its tolerability as a monotherapy is well established. In this study, adverse events were similar to those observed with aripiprazole monotherapy. Of particular interest is the greater incidence of akathisia in the patients taking lithium, although the study was not powered to detect differences between subgroups. However, most cases were mild to moderate, and the majority occurred early in the study. This feature suggests a potential sensitivity to the initial dose of aripiprazole. A lower starting dose may have been more tolerable. Additionally, akathisia resolved by the end of treatment in nearly one-third of the affected patients taking aripiprazole. Our final article is by Richard Meiser-Stedman and colleagues, who examine the post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis in preschool and elementary school-aged children exposed to motor vehicle accidents. They compared an alternative symptom algorithm for diagnosing post-traumatic stress disorder with the standard DSM-IV method. The alternative method reduces the required number of endorsed avoidance symptoms from 3 to 1. It also removes DSM-IV criterion A2, which concerns emotion at the time of trauma. Diagnoses were assessed in 114 children ages 2 to 10 years who had experienced a traumatic accident involving a motor vehicle. Parents completed structured interviews 2 to 4 weeks after the event, and again at 6 months. Children ages 7 to 10 were also assessed with a structured interview for PTSD. At the 2 to 4 week assessment, 12% of the children met the alternative criteria for PTSD, according to the parents' interviews. The rate was similar at the 6-month follow-up, 14%. On the other hand, the rates for DSM-IV acute stress disorder at the early assessment and PTSD at follow-up were 3% and 2%, respectively. This differential pattern was also seen in the subgroups of children ages 2 to 6 and 7 to 10. The authors examined the prognostic power of the diagnoses at the initial assessment with respect to diagnostic status at the 6-month follow-up. For the 2 to 6-year-old children, the estimates were all based on parental reports. For these children, a diagnosis of PTSD at 2 to 4 weeks based on the alternative algorithm was only a modestly sensitive predictor of PTSD at the 6-month follow-up. Half of those cases were undetected. However, it was a better predictor than DSM-IV acute stress disorder. For the children 7 to 10 years old, diagnostic stability was greater when the diagnoses were based on the combined reports of the parents and children than when they relied on either one alone. This was true for both the alternative algorithm and DSM. Agreement between parents and children was generally poor, and prevalence rates for this age group were higher when the diagnoses were based on the children's own reports or the combined interviews. However, the alternative PTSD diagnosis, based on parental report, was more sensitive than the one based on child report. For DSM, the opposite pattern was observed. Acute stress disorder based on the child's report was a more sensitive predictor than when the diagnosis was based on parental report. For the overall group of children, the PTSD diagnosis based on the alternative algorithm and parental reports was stable between time points. 65% of the children diagnosed at the initial assessment retained the diagnosis at 6 months. This demonstrates that a significant degree of the psychopathology indexed by the alternative algorithm persists over the first 6 months after trauma in young children. This was not the case for DSM diagnoses. With DSM, no children who were diagnosed at the initial assessment retained the diagnosis at the 6-month follow-up. For 2- to 6-year-old children, the data favor the alternative algorithm for diagnosing PTSD. This method identified more cases of post-traumatic psychopathology and showed better predictive validity and stability over 6 months. However, for 7 to 10-year-old children, the findings suggest that if parent and child-reported data are available, the alternative algorithm does not offer a clear advantage over the established DSM-IV diagnoses for acute stress disorder and PTSD. However, if the child's report of symptoms is not available, using the alternative algorithm with the parent's report appears to be preferable. In his editorial, Michael Scaringa outlined 6 contributions of the Meiser-Stedman study. Number 1, this is one of the larger studies to date on this topic, and it demonstrated an overall PTSD rate of 14% with the alternative criteria, compared to 2% with the DSM-IV criteria. The mean number of PTSD symptoms was about 10, indicating that these children were severely symptomatic. This is higher than in most adults diagnosed with PTSD. It seems implausible that children who have so many PTSD symptoms are unable to receive a DSM-IV diagnosis. Number 2, the prospective design showed that of the children diagnosed with PTSD, according to the alternative criteria 2 to 4 weeks after the trauma, 69% retained the diagnosis 6 months later. These data on predictive validity are another important reason for making developmental modifications in the DSM criteria. This finding adds to preliminary longitudinal research suggesting that PTSD in children may be more unremitting than in adults. Adult studies typically show that approximately 50% of patients improve naturally to some degree. Unremitting PTSD takes on new salience in early childhood, a time of uniquely rapid brain development. Number 3 is the inquiry into the developmental appropriateness of DSM-IV criteria for children 7 to 10 years old. The rate of diagnosis for this age group was 19% with the alternative criteria, compared with 2% for DSM. Number 4, this is the first published study of DSM-IV acute stress disorder in preschool children. The authors found a rate of 2% in this age group, which is substantially lower than rates found in older populations. Since acute stress disorder requires the detection of dissociative symptoms, it is not clear whether the lower rate is due to underdetection or whether these symptoms do not develop as easily in preschool children. Number 5, this was also the first study of preschool children to examine the predictive validity of acute stress disorder for later development of PTSD. With PTSD diagnosed by the alternative criteria at 6 months as the outcome measure, acute stress disorder was less predictive than simply making the diagnosis of PTSD with the alternative criteria 2 to 4 weeks after the trauma. Only one preschool child received a diagnosis of acute stress disorder, but 6 received a diagnosis of PTSD by the alternative criteria at 6 months. For the 7 to 10 age group, however, a diagnosis of acute stress disorder based on combined parent and child reports was a slightly better predictor than the early diagnosis of PTSD by the alternative criteria, but it still missed cases. And number six, this study examined the often neglected issue of the accuracy of child reports versus parent reports. It should not be surprising that parent-child agreement was poor. There appears to be little that can be done about it practically, but this helps to quantify just how much information clinicians are missing by having access only to parent reports. The data from this study fit with the consistent findings from prior studies that PTSD can be reliably detected in preschool children, and that cases diagnosed by the alternative criteria are of high severity with functional impairment. It suggests again that the alternative criteria are more developmentally sensitive and valid than the DSM-IV criteria. This concludes the audio highlights of the October issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. We invite you to our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the full text of these and other articles. We also welcome comments regarding this audio program. They can be emailed to Jane Weaver. Her email address is jweaver@psych.org. Thank you.